Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I am Chuck Phillips, joined by...
Hi, everybody. It's Justin.
And we're diving back into another series. Not as long as Apes. We're only a third of the length of Apes this time. We're not completely killing ourselves trying to cram a lot of
the perfect follow-up to Apes, actually. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. We're talking about the Before trilogy, starting off with Before Sunrise.
We're going in chronological order.
I'd say it's what made the most sense to us. I mean, you know, we could have gone any other direction, but
we decided to do the whole series, so we're not like, oh, you know, we don't want to touch it because we did Before Sunset.
Yeah, this is definitely one you got to do the whole thing of. You don't want to just like pull one of these movies out. And like you had mentioned before, I don't know if you ever said it on the podcast, because I don't think we ever said what we were talking about, but you said it separately. This is probably the most dialogue heavy film we've ever tried to discuss. You know, not a lot of action to just sit and go over the plot. This isn't this isn't what people would describe as a plot heavy film. You know, other movies we can sit there and talk about the story beats and, you know, go through that. And now this event happens and this event happens. This is basically one event in not real time, but just kind of unfolds. And, you know, there's parts of it that don't have anything to do with anything. And there's things that.
Well, it's more about the experience. It's an experience film. And I feel like they're a little bit harder to talk about. We can dissect them, but who knows where that goes?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like the film. You don't really know where it's going to go.
That's true. I hadn't...
I was just going to say, the only bad thing about doing Before Sunrise, well, doing all of these weekly, is the fact that I'm spreading them out weekly. I kind of wanted to watch them back to back to back. I guess I could.
You could. You don't have to limit yourself. You could do whatever you want. Yeah, I had never seen these films until they came out on the Criterion Collection when they released the whole series. And I would agree, when I first watched, after I watched this one, I immediately wanted to put in the next one, knowing that there's something coming after it. I guess if I was I don't know what it would have been like seeing this film when it first came out and just being like, are we ever going to find out what happens to them again? Like, just walking out and being like, I don't know, they said they were going to meet up again, but do they meet up again? You know, all those things. But the fact that at least by the time I got to it, there was already a trilogy, so I knew, okay, yeah, I could put the next one in and see what's going on, and then follow that up with Midnight.
Well, there is a part in the movie where they make a promise to meet up 5 years later. But you don't know you don't know if it works out. So that's probably the most ambiguous part of the whole movie, is if they do end up meeting back up, or maybe they don't. Maybe life doesn't take them that way. There's three movies, and they're in all of them, so that might spoil some things for you when you're jumping into them. Would. I find them fascinating. When I first watched this movie, it was in school, and it just kind of took me back, because I am a huge fan of films that the dialogue isn't expository. There's some of it in here, but it just the people having a conversation and kind of revealing who they are through that conversation, I've always enjoyed. And it's one of the reasons I love Pulp Fiction and really started to kind of fall in love with movies in general, because I was seeing something that I hadn't seen before. I guess I grew up with really shitty movies. But when I watched this movie, I was like, wow, it's just so fucking impressive, because all the story beats work so naturally. Everything feels right. I believe that this could happen. It doesn't have that kind of feeling that most romance films have, where they kind of just end up together at the end of the movie. There's this sort of time's running out feeling throughout the entire movie. And it's just a weird experience, and I feel like a lot of people have experienced this in some degree, maybe not a relationship where it was like a romantic interest, but you know, you've had a day where you've spent it with somebody else that's real as, you know, just somebody you kind of met up with, and then you kind of part your ways and never see them again.
Yeah, it's definitely an odd film, I guess, to like tell people about, because you know, if someone were to say to you, hey, what's that movie about? Oh, it's about two people and they talk and walk around, and that's it. They talk and walk around, like, but I do like the way that I will compare this to the other films I've been watching lately. After we got done with Midsummer, it reminded me that I bought that Ingmar Bergman set 3 years ago and had never watched a single movie out of it. So I figured I should probably start doing that. So I started watching those. I'm about six films into that. And that's a lot of Bergman's films. Like he has those ones like Summer Interlude and things like that, that it's just like people hanging out in summer and they talk about their lives. But the difference,
there's not a lot of drama.
Yeah, there isn't in a lot of these. Or there's like one, like Summer Interlude, there's not drama except the one guy dies partway through the movie and then the girl's like, yeah, kill the dog. And I'm like, what? And then it just goes right back to being people talking about their lives. And I'm like, well, that was a thing you just kind of passed over there, but okay. But this is probably the most realistic, I guess, like written film, like the way the dialogue is. You brought up Pulp Fiction, and I do love Pulp Fiction, and I love those type of movies that, you know, are very dialogue heavy. The Coen brothers are the same way. They have a lot of films that, like, the characters just rattle off dialogue like nonstop. They won't stop talking the entire film. But they're still like, I guess, like, I don't think this is a good word, but like a writer's way of talking. Like the characters never truly feel like that's a real person talking, at least not all the time. So they're better in some movies than others. Like Tarantino, like, I don't know, the beginning of Reservoir Dogs are talking about like tipping or something like that. Like that feels like a real conversation, but then you'll get like some other ones in some other films that don't necessarily feel like a real conversation. It feels like something that a writer thinks would be like a real conversation that someone would have. Or like when characters are a bit too knowledgeable about like referencing things, like they start getting like Scream characters where they all talk about like movie references. Everyone's a film buff.
Like an Aaron Sorkin film where everyone's rattling off. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorkin exactly. Says he's not even that smart. He just makes his character smart.
Exactly. That's how I felt. That's how I feel about watching those movies. And that's where I feel like with Bergman's films, like the characters all feel very realistic. The sets are all very realistic, but then these characters like talk about like killing themselves and how they're the insignificance of their lives. Like they're philosophizing about things that I'm just like, I was like, I don't know that anyone gets this deep on like, you know, hanging out at the beach one day with a girl you just met. But, this movie, everything feels just real. And I know that's what Richard Linklater said. He worked to like when he wrote the script and had like a general idea for what he wanted them to do, but then, you know, basically had to reinterpret it through, well, how would you say it, Ethan? Or how would Julie say it? Like, you know, he could like put the scenario that he needed on the page, but then he needed them to say it. Like I know they said in an interview that they gave that they could spend like 4 days just on figuring out, well, I don't know, the thing that you wrote, that would never make me actually get off a train. And then they had to sit there and figure out, well, what would be something that he could say that would actually make you, you know, get off a train and like abandon your life for a day.
Right. It sounds like Linklater looked for chemistry first and then actors that were going to kind of do the work and put themselves into it. I saw something where I guess Ethan Hawke kind of complained that no one's going to really think that he's acting. And Linklater said, well, that's the greatest compliment that you could have, is if people can't tell that how hard that you worked to pull off this role. He said they're essentially, you know, they're kind of versions of themselves, but Linklater did the right move in he takes a lot of their advice. He said that if he had a joke and the two of them didn't think that it was good, he cut it because he didn't want to have anything in there that just didn't feel right. And I guess it got to the point where, like, you know, they were writing their own dialogue, and they even were writing dialogue for, like, each other's characters. Like, they were just all over the place. And it sounded like Ethan Hawke would write 10 pages and Linklater would go through it and be like, these couple lines here are pretty good. Maybe we'll put them in. Yeah, I think that the movie works so well because they're very honest about what is going on. They know that there's this limited amount of time, and they know, they decide that they set the rules that they're not going to make anything big out of it. Although it kind of becomes that, like, what if, you know, what if this was the one that got away? This is the story that you're going to be thinking about for the rest of your life, more than likely. But everything comes off really natural. I like how the backstory kind of unfolds for them. I guess mostly Ethan Hawke's character, because Jolie Deppley doesn't have anything that's, like, too crazy. It just puts her in the right place at the right time, more or less.
Yeah.
But yeah. Don't you just dig their conversations, though? Like, the whole thing feels natural. It doesn't feel too crazy. Like, he doesn't, like you said earlier, where you have to convince me to get off this train. Like, the audience has to believe that I'm going to be the person that would get off, like, you would convince me to get off this train. You never know. Could go a different way. Ethan Hawke could be a serial killer. They do visit the Ferris wheel from The Third Man, so it's quite possible.
Yeah, everything, a lot of it comes down, yeah, to, like, I don't know, I guess they don't necessarily get into it in these exact terms, but it does come down to a lot of, I guess, fate and you could say destiny. Like, is it meant to be that they're supposed to be together? Eventually they meet up, they find, like, a gypsy fortune teller on the street, and there's a lot of great moments like that where every time something comes up where it seems like it's trying to push them together, but Ethan Hawke's always, like, kind of, like, trying to be, like, the cynic. Like, he doesn't believe the gypsy fortune teller who says, you know, oh yeah, you're going to meet someone, like, special, or however she phrases it. Like, yeah, you just keep doing it. And then she says, he's learning or something like that. And he gets, like, offended. Like, what does that mean? I'm learning. I know things. Or the poet that writes the poem for him. And, like, she's like, oh, that was so beautiful. And he's like, yeah, but, like, I bet he just, like, puts a word in that people give him. Like, he probably
didn't just write this thing.
Yeah, you know, he didn't just write that. Like he kind of always has to, like, bring down the moment every time she starts to, like, get more like romantic about it. Although I think later on, though, she's the one, as much as he tries to keep, like, putting it off, that, like, be more of, like, the cynical character. I think he's kind of, like, thrown off because she's the one that starts off with, well, we'll never meet again. And he kind of, like, looks at her like, oh, you don't think we'll meet again? He tries to deflect it a lot, but it's clearly, like, in his mind the whole time of, like, no, this is, like, the girl of my dreams. I'll meet her again and we'll get married. Like, he's been thinking about that the entire time. And as soon as she says, well, you know, we're not going to meet again, like, it kind of throws him off.
Linklater had a similar experience as what he based this off of. He said that there was this girl that he met when he was in Philly at a candy store or something. And he just kind of took the chance to be like, hey, I'm here for the night. Do you want to hang out? And he said that they, you know, they spent the whole night, like, walking around talking and stuff like that. But then they did correspond back and forth for a while when he went back to Texas. And then it just kind of, like, it wasn't as fun, or, and it kind of faded away. And then I guess he said that he found out, I think it was after Before Sunset even came out, he didn't know what happened to this person. And I guess the exact year that they were filming this, in 94, she was in, like, a very bad accident and she had passed away, and he never knew. But, like, that was, I mean, that's kind of a tragic story. And it's, I don't know, it just kind of feels like, he didn't know that going into it, but you do have that feeling that, you know, maybe you're never going to see this person again. I mean, on vacation, you meet people at the beach and you hang out with them the whole week and then you never see them again. I have a terrible memory, so I don't remember names or anything. I don't really remember those experiences either. But for a while, like right after, like you go to, if you go to like a summer camp or something, it is kind of weird to be like, oh, I'm going to be leaving all these people. And
yeah,
we really hit it off well.
I mean, it even becomes the same, like, I guess it's a little bit different now with obviously like social media and everyone's a lot more connected than they were even in, you know, 1994 when they were filming this. This was still pretty early for even the internet. But even back then it would be like people that you went to school with, like you'd graduate and then, I don't know, they disappear. I still live, you know, at home. I graduated in 2008. So that was 13 years ago. I would say in 13 years, I still talk to like two people that I went to high school with. Other than that, I couldn't even tell you where most of those people, if they even still live here or they left, because it's just like people move apart, you go in different directions. So yeah, that idea that just meeting one person and trying to make a plan, and like we said, how they don't want to,
time's against you too.
Yeah. And he almost says like it would be worse to exchange information, because they said, you know, if we give each other our address and phone number, you know, I'll write you a letter once or twice, you know, we'll talk a couple times. So kind of like you were saying, like that Richard Linklater corresponded with that girl a couple more times after they met. And it sounds like it works into here, because he says, you know, it'd almost be better off that either, like if it's meant to be, we'll come back and meet each other again. And if it's not, then we'll never see each other again. It'd be even worse to kind of like string it out along and keep sending letters back and forth. But knowing that you're never going to go back to, you know, Richard Linklater's never going to go back to Philly just to like live with this girl. And she's probably not going to uproot her whole life to move to Texas to live with him or something. So to like send those letters back and forth.
He said he had been back to Philly and just had, he like never, anytime he was there, he always thought maybe I'd run into her again. And he never did. But it's like, I don't know, I don't run into Richard Linklater very often. And he's been in Pittsburgh quite a bit. Originally, this was supposed to take place in San Antonio. And then they shifted it to the more like European. And I think that works so much better, because I don't know if it necessarily makes each character more interesting, but it makes them more of a mystery to each other. Like it, you don't really know where they've come from. I really like Ethan Hawke's backstory too, where he went there to essentially be with his girlfriend and she had already moved on and didn't want him out there. And it's nice. I kind of like that too, how it slowly gets revealed over the course of the movie too. So you do have like surprises as things go on.
Yeah, there's a lot of good moments like that, intermixed with a lot of really mundane things. But I don't know, they still add up to it. Like I can remember after watching the movie the first time, and then after watching it this time, the characters that I remember for having like no lines in it, but it's just still like an interesting part of their story. Like the two guys they meet on the bridge, and they're both kind of like real smart with them about, oh, you speak English? He's like, oh, maybe you could try speaking German for a change. He's like, what? And he's like, oh, I'm just joking. Like,
that was a snarky, like, but yeah, what you would expect.
And then like they like try to make it up to him, and they're like, come see our play. I'm the cow. I'm like, what do you do? And
he's
like,
cow.
He's like, I smoke cigarettes with my hoof. Like he keeps going over everything.
I do things a cow shouldn't do.
Yeah. But, and it's like a great callback later when they're sitting there in the morning, and yeah, Ethan just goes, we never went to those guys' play. It's like it's just such a throwaway, like it's such a small part. It has nothing
to
do with
the
rest of
the story. And she already forgot about it. And that's something from their night.
Yeah, she forgot about it entirely. So yeah, and I agree. I think going to a different setting, because they're kind of both foreigners in that place, instead of setting it in America, being that they're in Vienna, she's from France and he's from America. So they're both like, neither one of them is really like knows about anything there. So they're both kind of interested in what's going on. It's not like a, oh yeah, I can show you this, I can show you this. So yeah, I do agree that doing the European settings, which obviously carries over into the other films when we get to those, that they're all set in different places in Europe.
The style changes a little bit over the course of them too.
Yeah, it changes, which that's one of the great things with Linklater between this and Boyhood, and I think the movie's working on now, which I can't remember the title. It had like a weird title. It was like Together We Roll or something like that. Which
Bernie,
I think he's
too.
Yeah, he's also filming that movie. It's supposed to take place over 20 years, so he's doing the, I think they said he's kind of doing the same thing where he's gonna film the actors like every few years to show how they're aging.
We'll probably cover Boyhood at some point too. But I always found that interesting, where basically they set it up: if I die before this is over, then Ethan Hawke was supposed to take over. And it's sort of weird too, because like, you depend on, you don't want anything to happen to the kids, but anything could happen to any of the actors. And then they're gone, and then you got to reflect the story to fit the fact that, you know, one of them might have passed. I don't know. So far they've set themselves a deadline of 9 years, so they would have to be filming something this year.
It was interesting. I already, before we recorded earlier today, I already saw an article talking about how they're not working on it. It came from Julie Delpy, and she more or less said that she hasn't completely retired from acting, but that she's like, she said she's fed up with not being able to get any projects going. Like, she keeps trying to work on getting films started that, you know, she finds interesting, and she said no one will finance them. You know, everyone just wants to, like, in her mind, everyone just wants to make big action movies. No one wants to make her type of movies. And she said, like, that kind of upset her to the point that, like, Richard Linklater, I guess, asked her, like, a year or two ago about making another one, and she kind of just said no. Like, she's just kind of mad at the industry in general, I guess. So,
you know, when they started something making changed, the second one, she said that she lost her manager. He fired her because she was up for some like big blockbuster movie, and she didn't show up because she went to go talk to Linklater about doing Before Sunset. And I guess between her and Ethan Hawke, like, everybody was like, does anybody want a sequel to that movie? Like, is anybody asking for another one of those movies? And I think that's pretty funny. They're like, it's the lowest grossing trilogy of all time, the Before trilogy.
That was the Criterion Blu-ray has a good interview with Richard Linklater and Ethan Hawke. And they have a few good, like, behind-the-scenes stories talking about making the film. And Richard Linklater said, like, one of the funniest things he remembers was, like, sitting there with Ethan reading the script. And he said, like, Ethan would just sit there and go, Richard, who's financing this film? Like basically the same way, like who's making this movie? Like, who greenlit this and said, like, yeah, make a movie about people walking around talking for an hour and a half? Like even Ethan Hawke at the time was like, I can't believe anyone would greenlight this film to be made.
He said it's the movie that you always want to do, but you would never really have the opportunity to do it. I mean, and it's true. When would you have that? Most actors, they get their little bit in the movie and that's it. Or even if they're the main character, they don't have a lot of – they might have the most screen time, but some of them might not even have 50% of the runtime. I don't know. I do think, we'll talk more about the plot and everything when we get there, but I do think that this trilogy has like a good, it stops in an interesting place. And I know they were talking about them like maybe doing it when they were older, like later in life, but I don't know I have no idea what the stories would be. There's some things that I'll have to bring up for when we're talking about Midnight that I found interesting. But yeah, I'd be cool if they wanted to, because what we got, 20s, 30s, 40s, so it's 50s now. What if they skip it and they just do 60s, 70s, 80s? Linklater, I think they said, was 10 years older than them, so maybe he can't make 80s.
Yeah, eventually Ethan will have to take over for him. But yeah, that's the thing with all three of these films. Again, like I said, if you went to see this film in 1994, not knowing that they were ever going to do another one, I guess you would definitely sit there and it leaves you with that ambiguous ending. But I feel like all three of these movies, they end in a place that leaves things open, but I would not be upset. I wouldn't be upset if like it ends with Midnight, if that were the end. Like, I know there's places they can go and it leaves you, you know, wondering where their relationship is by the end of that film. But if that was the end, it's not the worst thing in the world. Even the way this film ends, if that was the end and they never did another one, I'd still be perfectly fine with it.
That's how all three movies are. I feel you get to the end and you're like, I'm satisfied if that's the last one. Every time you get to the next one, I think this is the movie that they showed when I was in film school. So I sought out the second one and I was blown away with it. I don't understand. Linklater is more experimental than you think, like until you start digging into his filmography, you know, Waking Life or even Boyhood that we were talking about.
Yeah, he does some Scanner strange. Darkly is weird.
Well, even like Bernie that I brought up, it was based on like an actual killer that he like let live in his basement while he wrote the script.
Yeah, and it's like half of it's a documentary, like it's actual interviews with the people there, but then the other half is Shirley MacLaine and Jack Black and Matthew McConaughey acting out the parts of the main characters.
Like, right, or he does these really cool things with, like, I really liked Everybody Wants Some, which was like his pseudo Dazed and Confused sequel, and I'm like, that's the only way you could do a Dazed and Confused sequel. How else would you do it? You're not going to bring them all back.
Well, yeah, they're definitely all, you can't keep in that like same time frame, I guess.
Slacker is like the weirdest. It has like no, I guess that's the predecessor for this. There's no plot to it. It just kind of, the story just follows whoever it feels is interesting. Like, it just keeps going from person to person to person.
Yeah, I had to look up because I feel like I sometimes forget some of the movies that Richard Linklater did. Like, I always forget that he did the Bad News Bears remake with Billy Bob Thornton. And I always forget that he did School of Rock. It just always...
I remember School of Rock because when I went to Point Park, they showed us School of Rock to basically teach basic plot points in a story because it was like very simplistic. And Missy, that we've had on the podcast before, she does casting and she was on Last Flag Flying, I believe. I might have messed up her role or something. But she said a real interesting thing where she got to talk to him and she's like, oh, we studied you in school. We all had to study School of Rock. And he's like, School of Rock? Like, why School of Rock? I guess he was probably thinking something more clever. When I was in school, at least for the most part, they tried to make us watch things that they knew that we hadn't seen. So we weren't watching stuff like Pulp Fiction. We were watching stuff like this. And this kind of blows my mind because it is the perfect movie of collaboration. It's not just like Linklater is the best screenwriter, but maybe he's one of the best filmmakers because he knew how to approach this movie. And I think that is the most interesting thing where it's like, he talks about how it's about these people that are connecting for the very first time and realizing that they understand and really like each other. But you keep that going for over 90 minutes is really impressive. Because I feel like most movies would do something like, I don't know, I'm thinking like Revolutionary Road, where it has like a nice like, oh, they met. Although Revolutionary Road's cool because it jumps into the future and they hate each other. But I hate, like, romance movies. The thing that bothers me the most about them is that they don't usually feel very real. Like, I get people like romantic comedies, but I've always hated the idea of, I always found it worse. And this is kind of like the what I would like to see, where they're very realistic and they're like, we don't know if we ever meet up again, as opposed to they get together at the end of the movie and it's like they have this idea like love is going to be so perfect and their life's going to be wonderful together. And you know that it's not, because they don't know anything about each other. At least in this movie, all they do is reveal things about each other. And you watch anything else, and it's like, they got together, but what do they don't know. They're attracted to each other, and they don't know a goddamn thing about each other. I always found that off. I would rather have characters that connect. And I think that I think Linklater did a really good job kind of like balancing out the Julie Depley in this too. She doesn't really have a single protagonist. It really is equal time with both of them.
Yeah. I like getting into just like the thoughts that run through their head too, especially especially the way Ethan Hawke, like I 100% believe that some of like the weird things that he mentions in the movie are things that Ethan Hawke has actually come up with, like his idea for a cable access show that's 365 days of, you know, watching somebody in one place do their entire day throughout the life, or his idea of destroying the idea of reincarnation, when he's like, but how can everyone be reincarnated if we have so many new people coming every day? Like, how can there possibly be reincarnation? Like, if everyone gets a new body, then how do we get that many more people all the time? So some of the interesting things that that he starts coming up with are just like, they kind of stick with you, like more than you would think. Those kind of like real throwaway moments that, again, like I said, don't feel like they have any bearing on the plot whatsoever. But they just give you a little bit of idea of his mind, because he just feels like he has like a, like, I don't want to say paranoid, but he just has that mind that like is constantly coming up with scenarios for like why things would be bad, you know, but like why everything could go wrong, I guess, for him, you know. Like if someone's like, oh yeah, your life's looking pretty good, like he's a little bit of a pessimist, or it's like
he's also very death obsessed.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he is.
He's very dark. I like when he's sitting on the railing and they have that conversation about how it almost feels like a dream, because they're in this foreign place with this foreign person, and essentially they're gonna wake up. The next day it's all gone. And I think that's what it would kind of feel like. That experience afterwards, exactly what it feel like. You go back home. I don't think they ever specify where he's from. At least in the first movie.
I don't think so.
I don't remember the rest. He just drops it. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm from Texas. I'm sure he's from Texas. I'm just going to assume that it's Texas. It's Austin, Texas. Yeah, and he wasn't in Dazed and Confused either. I think he said that he met him at the Dazed and Confused screening. I can't even remember who he went to.
He said he was there with Anthony Rapp because they were in a play together.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now it would be Jack Black. It's either Jack Black or Ethan Hawke. Those are his go-tos.
Those are his boys. He looks to either one of them for inspiration.
He's good at finding young actors that want to put themselves out there, too. I think mostly of Everybody Wants Some, which is like the most recent thing, and I thought he had a really good cast in that, and some of those people have gotten pretty big. I know the one guy is Superman now on, I don't know what it's called, Superman and Lois or something.
He had Captain America in it.
Yeah, well,
a Captain America.
I feel like he might have, I really do like Wyatt Russell, but I think that he would have maybe made it on name too. He doesn't have a Kurt Russell type feel to him, but at least in Everybody Wants Some, like, he has this good stoner vibe to him that has carried him through a lot of the performances he's in. He was just in that Woman in the Window that I watched on Netflix. It was all right, but it was a really good cast. Like, the whole cast was like everyone fucking walked in. And I was like, holy shit. Like, every person is like a known person in this movie. That's the Amy Adams movie that's on Netflix.
Yeah, that's what it definitely seems like. Linklater is like, he's not one of those guys that the script is 100%. Like, it seems like even from the very beginning with like we were saying, like, Slacker is kind of like just all over the place, just whatever he wanted to do there. And then, he mentioned like Dazed and Confused. He really wanted to like work with all those kids. Cause I think he was probably older than them at the time. And, you know, he's probably thinking back to his high school days, but like all these kids are actually in high school right now or had just graduated recently. So, he definitely has a good working style that I think really does like bring out good performances by, you know, yeah, coming to an actor and saying like, hey, this is the script. Like,
I mean, you realize too that he found McConaughey more or less.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't have him if it wasn't for Richard Linklater, or Rick, as they call him.
Yeah. He's Rick to his friends.
He is Rick. Cause when I was trying to get on Last Flag Flying, they didn't have a position for me, but, my boss was like, you know, if Rick could take you, he would take you. He'd love you. And I'm thinking, oh, that's nice to say. Oh, and I don't have the job, but that was nice. And he's been here twice in Pittsburgh recently, which honestly, I haven't seen. What was it called? Where Did You Go, Bernadette?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. It got buried. I think it came out in theaters in like 2019, but it was filmed like 2 years prior.
Yeah, it was like real limited release.
I don't even remember seeing a trailer for it. I think I saw pictures of Kate Blanchett in a kayak. That's weird because I'm usually on top of all his stuff. And that I wasn't. Boyhood too.
Boyhood flew under your radar. You weren't ready.
Boyhood
for it.
I saw in theaters, and that was one of the movies where I was like, oh man, that's so fucking good. What a risk too, to put that much time into something. I mean, he said he was only filming about a week a year for 12 years, but it, wow. I think, like, how do you know? Like, you've picked, like, even the kids that he picked to be in it, that, well, the main character too, you don't know how they're going to grow up and how they're going to be. Maybe they're a terrible actor. He's really good at getting these performances out of people. I don't know if I've seen that kid in more things since. I don't know. It kind of blows my mind. And yeah, this is one where it's a movie that I recommend a lot, but I don't necessarily know how people will like it, because it's hard for me to say, hey, you might like this movie. There's not a lot going on throughout the course of the movie, but it might have the best characters in any movie, besides the sequels, I guess. But yeah, it's a cheat. It's a cheat, because they're not... Filmmaking is supposed to be a collaborative process, and this is about as close as you're going to get to it.
Yeah, this is like the exact opposite of, you know, anyone that references like auteur theory and things like that about, oh no, the director's, he's 100% the guy in charge, and, you know, everything is what his vision is. And this is definitely that exact opposite of, he came in and said, no, you know I can't just make this movie, and it won't be believable. I feel like if he sat there and really tried to like kill any decision that they made of, you know what, I think my character should say that. No, you got to read it like I wrote it on the page. Like, you'd get those moments where it's like, man, that didn't feel realistic. That didn't seem like something that somebody would say or do.
Well, I mean, when you write something, and in film school, we've wrote things, and then you have people perform them. when they're not very good actors, it doesn't really matter how good your dialogue is. So, well, they always say, kill your darlings. So I think as long as you have the basic plot there, you can wing it a little bit. I would rather have somebody say something that sounds competent than maybe the what I thought was gold that I put on the paper. Whatever they're comfortable with saying, as long as it makes sense, I think it's all in. Well, now you kind of get the same thing with a lot of these Judd Apatow comedies. They do the same thing where there's more of a, there's a script or an outline, but they kind of, they go on the improv. And I think the editor saves these movies, because every time they do the director's cut where they add 40 minutes and it's literally like, I think what wasn't super bad, Bill Hader and Seth Rogen going back and forth for maybe 10 minutes. I'm like, you didn't cut it at all. Like, I don't understand. Like, you kept everything in there to the point that it's not even, you're kind of taken away from it being enjoyable, because it just goes on for far too long. These movies don't. These movies are actually fairly short. I think Sunset's only like 80 minutes. It's real quick.
So yeah, Sunset's the shortest one. That one really like gets in and out.
It gets in and out. Gets in and out. That movie starts and then it leaves. It's done. That movie is quick. I'm used to movies being long anymore. I feel like anytime I go to a movie, it's 3 hours long, and it's like something you don't expect to be 3 hours long.
They've been getting longer. Yeah, I saw somebody wrote about that, like, why are all these movies getting so long? Like, they brought up In the Heights. I recently watched that. That's a 2.5-hour movie. And, I mean, I think they said the musical is like, if you went to see the actual musical, it's like 4 hours long. But so it's still cut down. But they were like, it's a musical and it's 2.5 hours. I think they said Cruella was the same. They said Cruella's like 2.5 hours long.
That's a movie I wouldn't expect to be that long.
Yeah.
In the Heights, I guess, like, I could get if you're cutting down that production. I can see that. Well, also, it's going to be somewhat shorter because they take their time to change out the sets and stuff when you're actually seeing the musical.
Yeah, it would be longer, and I'm sure they had an actual intermission in the musical itself.
And they definitely added that to the time.
So it's like, there's a reason that it is that long.
Sometimes our things are like, I don't know, you go to see there's a new Ice Age movie, and you go see it, and it's like 2.5 hours. You're like, why the fuck was that movie that long?
The new,
that's not a true example. That's just...
The new Fast and Furious is 2.5 hours long.
Why? Because they have so many people? I don't know.
Yeah, probably. It's like, yeah, I don't know why. It's a weird thing, because it's... Yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah, it is a weird thing. It's a really weird thing.
I can't describe, what's the reason? Like, why these movies are all getting longer and longer? Is it like they just feel like they need to, like, it almost feels like you need to justify why you spent $200 million on a car crash movie and be like, oh, it's 2.5 hours long. Like, have you seen it? It's a long movie. Like, I don't know if that's like somebody's thought process there. It was like you're spending like how many dollars per minute that the film's running. And it's like, well, the longer the film runs, the longer it seems like you spend. Some things make sense to me to an extent.
Such as like the Avengers movies, when you got to like the final two Avengers movies, I felt, yeah, those had to be long. You have like 20 characters in each movie now. Well, the end of the first of Infinity War kind of fixed that. So like, let's get rid of a bunch of these characters. Let's have a more focused story in the next one. It's weird where like you feel like you're getting to the climax of the movie and you're like, wait, there's how much time left? And then there's movies like The Godfather or The Shining, and they don't feel long to me at all. I sit and watch it. It feels like a 2-hour movie tops, and they're not. Well, I think that's the thing. I think that's the thing with runtime. Your movie should never feel long. So these movies that have like three plots and shouldn't really be all in a single movie, I think that's when things feel long. Like we watched Batman versus Superman, and that's a movie that feels like it's 10 hours long. It feels like it's the longest movie of all time, because it's everything's crammed in there and it doesn't have to be, and there's zero focus in the entire movie, and I'm like, I can't believe it. No one's telling Snyder no, I guess, for this. And that's not really a knock on him. That's just like, I don't know. You got to be more like a Linklater. You got to be somebody that talks to the people.
You'd almost think, well, I guess with so much stuff that was streaming this past year, that didn't really matter as much. But my thought was you'd almost think that they'd want to try to keep these movies like a tight running time, because then you get more showings of it. Like the longer the movie is, the less showings you can have per theater. If it's a 3-hour movie and, you know, the movie theater doesn't even open up till like noon or something like that, you can only show it like 4 times a day in one theater. Whereas if it was an hour shorter, you could run it like 6 or 7 times.
They were pissed when Return of the King came out around here because that was it. They get like 3 showings of it, maybe a day per screen. So now it's taking up, to show more of them, it's taking up more of their screens.
Yeah, so that's like a weird thing of like why they're like, you'd think there'd be more of an incentive to keep these movies trimmed down to a good pace.
Yeah, runtime doesn't bother me. I don't feel like I gain more with a longer runtime, or that I'm ripped off if the runtime is really short, because the budget can go into it different ways. Like, we're going to get into it in our very next episode when we talk about Before Sunset, but it feels right at, it's like, what, 80-minute runtime or whatever the hell it has. It's real short.
Yeah, I know it's less than 90 minutes.
It's the bare minimum of a film. Actually, I think a film has to be 40 minutes, right?
To be considered a feature, technically, it's 40. Well, I don't know if they've changed any of their rules. I know that's actually in the Herschel Gordon Lewis set. They had to pad their films out because they said if they just filmed like all the gore scenes, it only added up to like 40 minutes. And they're like, you got to add more. So then that's where they get like the stupid scenes of like people playing like jug band music or something. Like, why are those guys in it? Oh, we needed like an extra 10 minutes in this movie to make it a feature length. But yeah,
I made the mistake of watching Pink Flamingos recently. Did you see that movie?
I've only seen like bits and pieces, like the scenes that everyone like posts and is like, this is the grossest scene I've ever witnessed or something like that. I've seen those pop up.
It's not really that bothers me as much as it's just like all like exploitation. Like, it's only trying to be as gross as it possibly can and doesn't care about the plot. And I was just sort of like, why the fuck am I watching this movie? Like, I think Steph's going to come downstairs and be like, are these people fucking and killing chickens? I'm like, they are. That is what's happening in this moment.
Yeah, it is.
What's the story? I don't think there is one.
It is funny, like the parallels that I've been seeing, especially going back and forth now that we're starting to watch these 3 films. Like I said, I started watching that Bergman set, and I'm watching it in the order that Criterion like presents it in, is doing it like
that weird order.
That weird order where they're like, oh, it's like a film festival, and it starts off with Smiles of a Summer Night, which is like from his like 13th movie, and then it jumps straight back to his first movie. So it's like you go immediately from like, this movie's really good, back to like his first movie, and you're like, bah, that movie was okay.
I'm slightly jealous of you because I've been wanting to dive into that set and I haven't yet. I have watched a bunch of those though because like 10 or 11 movies, and I think I watched all of them before that set came out.
I know the only one I had ever watched, the only one I ever watched beforehand before getting this set was Seventh Seal. That was the only one I had gotten into. So I finally pulled it out, and
did you get to Virgin Spring yet? I think that's one of my favorite ones.
That one's later. I think that one's getting close to the end. Because, yeah, they're in a weird order. Most of the ones I've been watching are all of his early ones. I watched Wild Strawberries. I thought that was really good.
I really
like that one. And it's the director of The Phantom Carriage. And he's great in that movie. Like, I really enjoyed that one. But it's one of those things, too, like how we brought up Ethan Hawke's character is like very death obsessed, and he does have a few lines in this movie where he sounds like characters in some of these Bergman movies, where it's like all of these movies, I don't want to say he's a downer, but man, they're like
I think you are.
I guess I am going to say it. He's a little bit of a downer with some of these, especially these very early movies. It's like every film, I've watched six movies so far, and every single film, at least one time in the movie, someone has said, maybe I should just kill myself. And I'm like, geez, Ingmar, like, what is with you? Like, I understand, Sweden might be a depressing, cold, desolate place, but God, why does everyone want to kill themselves all the time in all of your films? I'm six movies
in. Or Midsummer, you come to Sweden and we kill you.
Yeah.
Sweden's a deadly place.
It's a deadly place. I don't know. I guess that just must be, how it is for people, or at least it was when he was growing up. It wasn't a very cheerful place to be.
I still love that behind the scenes photo. It's probably my favorite one of him directing The Seventh Seal, and he's like sitting there in the woods and it's like kind of foggy. It's like the best, it's one of the best photos I've ever seen. And it's just him like discussing a scene or something. I'm like, what? So cool. Because how long ago was that probably filmed? It's 80 50, years ago, maybe now.
57. What, that'd have been 60, 64 years.
Come on, do math on the podcast.
Yeah. I don't do good with that. So yeah, that was a while ago. But yeah, there's a lot of connections though. In these films, like I would say, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know that I've seen Linklater mention it, but the way those stories play out, they are very similar in the way that Bergman does. He always, most of these films take place over like one evening, or you know, even just a couple of days. Like that's Wild Strawberries is like the one drive through the countryside, and then there's flashbacks that go back and forth in time with the main character. But
well, we know Linklater watches all these things. One of my favorite stories was he was obsessed with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and it's like one of his favorite movies of all time. And Quentin Tarantino had found like a good reel of it, and he's like, He was going to gift it to him, and then he watched it and he really liked the movie, so he kept it for himself. Like that's one of my favorite stories.
That sounds exactly like something Tarantino would do. Like, hey, I found this print of this movie you like, and then watch it. Oh, that movie's good. Nah, I'm keeping it.
Yeah, that's my movie now. But he's watching all these things, so I think the influence is still there, because his mindset. He's the filmmaker, essentially. He's the one thinking of the shots, and it definitely has that European vibe. Obviously, that's the setting, and we could talk about that too, how the setting might play into that feeling. But it definitely has that vibe of these foreign films. But he takes a lot of ideas from Ethan and Jolie, like they're younger than him, and she was saying that, you know, she came up with that telephone thing, and she thought that it might be too immature to do. And he's like, no, let's try it. Let's do it. Like, I think it actually makes the scene more interesting, because it's just you guys walking around talking. So we need interesting. Yeah. I can't knock this movie at all. Like it might not be your thing. Like if you're bored within the first 10 minutes of the movie, you're not going to like any of it. But if you're the person that likes to have a good conversation, I mean they're having the conversation for you, but I think that it flows very, very nicely. The philosophy that they talk about, just their feelings that they talk about, and how they decide to be like real open and honest through the whole thing. I think that's the coolest part of it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, getting into that dialogue, you know, when Ethan Hawke says, this is a good bridge. And she goes, yeah. I just think of that, because that was like an example they played of in the behind the scenes thing, talking about the, you know, sometimes your conversations are real mundane, and then it cuts straight to that clip of him going, this is a nice bridge.
That's a good moment too, because they admit how bad the conversation is, and then the camera pans to those weird guys
the weird actors.
The Austrian guys that are doing the actors in the play. That's pretty great. You don't get that too often either, where something kind of is like surprising. But I do like the fortune teller too, where they make eye contact and then the camera just follows her. And you just get the narration from Ethan Hawke where he's like, oh shit, we made eye contact with her. Oh, she's coming over. Is she coming over? Yep, she's coming over now.
Yeah, everything. I don't know. I feel like it's almost, I want to say like almost impossible for anybody to watch this movie and not like recognize things that you've done or had happen even in just like your conversations. Like I know 100% the part where like the two monks are walking by and he's like narrating their time. He's like, oh, Father Smith, guess what? I'm not wearing underwear under here. And he's like, oh, and he like does that. And it's like, everyone's done that at some point. Like you see people walking by and you're like, oh, wonder what they're talking about. And you like start, you know, you'll start doing voices for them. Like, oh, I bet they're having a goofy conversation or something like that. So yeah, it is all those moments that, like I said, I feel like unless you live under a rock or just, yeah, don't get out or something like that. Like everyone has had,
I like your cliche. Like I want somebody to be living under a rock. Be like, what's so bad about living under a rock? Yeah, I'm listening to your podcast. You're going to insult me like that.
Yeah. I'm living under a rock here and you're going to tell me that, but yeah, like there's gotta be something in this movie that you're going to recognize and say, oh yeah, that's happened to me. I've had that moment. I've done that. I feel like I've experienced that at some point in my life.
Well, it's nice to experience things. I think this movie too, like Julie Depley, I don't see in too many things. Ethan Hawke, he's all over the place now. And I feel because he's that so damn handsome. Handsome Hawke. I think this is the movie that made me kind of like notice him as an actor and be like, he's actually really fucking good. And then he gets things like, I don't think I've seen The Purge or Sinister, but I know a lot of people love him for that. And I'd be like, hey, go see Before Sunrise because you're going to love it. If you love The Purge, you'll definitely love Before Sunrise. I think there would definitely be people that would watch this and not be a fan of it, though.
Yeah. I mean, there's some people that get, can't help but look at their phones and, you know, if there's not an explosion happening on the screen or something that really catches your eye or a car crash or something like that, you know.
I'm going to share this on the Criterion page that I follow on Facebook. This is, I mean, they probably have all watched it, most of them watch it. But I see on there a lot of times people will, I don't get it. I see this all the time. It's not necessarily Criterion movies or this page that I'm talking about. But they'll start a movie and they're like, I just started this movie. What's everyone's thoughts on it? I don't know. Finish the fucking movie. Then maybe ask for people's thoughts. I see that too for, I'm on a Stephen King page too. And they do the same thing.
I just bought this book. What's everyone's thoughts on it?
I don't know. Read the fucking book. What are your thoughts on the book? Why don't you read it and tell us your thoughts? I'm tired of giving like you my thoughts.
Yeah, like the person that as soon as you get up and leave the movie theater, what did you think of it? Like, you need to inform my opinion. I can't make a decision for myself. Tell me how I should feel.
Hey, some movies I can't even, I don't even know what I feel when I leave. I couldn't describe what I feel. And you don't want to have that mundane conversation either where you're like, oh, this happened and that happened and I liked when that happened. That was great. I have been out too where we've, like, I remember seeing movies and we're talking about it and somebody's like, can you not talk about that movie? We're about to see it. I think the last time that happened, though, was Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. So I don't think we really ruined anything. I think we were out with Chris and he said something like, oh, aliens. And so he's like, excuse me, do you mind not ruining that movie? I'm like, what the fuck do you think's going to happen in that movie? Sorry for spoiling it.
Yeah, maybe there's someone on this podcast that, you know, they were going to watch Before Sunrise, then they were going to follow that up with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and now you've just ruined their double feature.
Yeah, they were okay with listening to the Before Sunrise podcast, but then I fucked up. Their Indiana Jones marathon that they're about to revisit. Really fucked that up. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, even us, our conversations kind of go all over the place where we don't necessarily talk about the plot. I guess we can't talk about the plot on this very often. It's two people meet and decide to spend the evening together just enjoying each other's company.
That's it.
Could you imagine trying to sell that to a studio? Just standing in there and be like, it's just two people enjoying each other's company. It's very nice. It doesn't come off as fake, though.
It always feels real. I think they all do.
Yep. And we're spreading them out. So next, we're not going to be as crazy with the apes. As Chuck said, we have a third of them. So instead of doing 2 a week, we're just going to do 1 a week. And we have everything planned for a good chunk of the year. And we definitely have some really good movies coming up, I think. I like teasing things. I think I say the same thing at the end of every episode. I'm like, I'm not going to tell you, but it's good shit. I had somebody at work like, what's the podcast about tonight before sunrise? I've never seen that. Well, I don't know. If it's too obscure, maybe no one will listen to this.
Yeah, we'll see.
Maybe if this does midsummer.
Yeah, I was about to say, we'll see if this does midsummer numbers.
But yeah, I can't wait to kind of get to the end too. Not to jump to the end of all of them, but they do connect in interesting ways as the movies go on. So that's something that I can't really talk about till we get through one movie. So I feel like when we get to Before Sunset, we're going to be talking about Sunrise, and when we get to Midnight, we'll be covering all of them slightly. But yeah, I'm impressed, Chuck. We had a pretty good conversation about this movie. I think that we found what we talk about best. It's these movies that make us think a little bit harder. I don't know if think about a little bit harder is even the right word, but they're deeper. They're a little like this is a lot more philosophical, and there's a lot of questions out there, and I think when you end up watching this movie and these conversations that they're going through, they're conversations that you genuinely care about and find interesting. Yeah, and it could have very easily with the wrong cast be like some snob that you're like, I don't fucking like these people.
Yeah. I don't say too often that there's perfect movies, but I don't know. This is pretty close to, like you were saying, if it had been cast with anyone differently or, you know, any other changes, if they, you know, made it longer, tried to add extra dialogue, you know, change things, I don't think it would work as well. So it's, yeah, this one gets up there is pretty close to being perfectly made in my opinion.
I'm glad you enjoyed it too, because I remember when you first got them, and like, there's always that good feeling. I don't even think I've recommended it or not, but maybe spoke about it.
But I remember you saying because it was on that ridiculous sale where they accidentally marked it way too low on Amazon. You were like, buy this movie right now.
It's not the price it's supposed to be. Get it? It's very cheap, and yeah, you watch it. And I don't know. I have a really good feeling when I like when somebody watches a movie, and not that I thought that your expectations were low, but I really love when people watch something. You're like, wow, that was really good. Like, I got through all of them, and like I'm thinking really hard about them after a couple of days, and it's really sticking with me. So that feels good, especially when it's something that's like you wanted to do. It's like I want to do all of these. Like that's awesome. These are great movies, and I. Excited about the point when we get to talk about them, or even ones that I pick. And it's like, I remember Asphalt Jungle went over way better than I thought. Like, everyone was like, oh, that was a great movie. I'm like, finally, because usually I like a movie and everyone's like, that movie kind of sucked, Justin. And I'm like, sorry, I will poorly explain why I enjoy the movie. Anyways, we're back to a more normal schedule after we did our weird. What 5 weeks of apes.
Yeah.
A weird...
Lots of apes.
A week off, and then we went to Midsummer, the director's cut. And check out the original Midsummer episode, because, well, actually, we know that you have. It's our most popular of all time.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I guess that's pretty much for Sunrise. Richard Linklater's 1995 romance film. And probably my favorite romance film. And we cover two of them, because I really do like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Like, those are the two that come to my mind, even though that's maybe not the most romantic of movies. But the concept of it is wonderful. Yeah. Good pick. Anyways, we're Cinema D'Amore. We'll be back next week. You can... It won't be much of a surprise, but you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll reveal our next movie, which will definitely be Before Sunset. And on Twitter, I'm at JJMorgan19. I've been saying the weird things that I've been watching, although I did leave out Before Sunrise. I didn't tell anybody.
Because you wanted that mystery.
I don't know why. Maybe I wanted to be a surprise for the podcast. Because it's kind of a spoiler to be like, hey, I'm watching this movie, and then all of a sudden we're talking about it, which happens quite a bit. I do want to talk to you after this about a movie that I just watched where I thought that it was like such a product of its time. Not a good movie. It wasn't good. It had one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen, but it was also a terrible movie. Mm. We'll let everybody wonder what that is, and next week I'll try to reveal. Have a good night, everyone.
See ya.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.